July 6, 2005, a portion of the second formal interview with Professor Stephen Bourne, who will, on this section, address his research interests, including his involvement with the Wisconsin IDEA. Steve?
The same kinds of areas I've talked about in terms of my teaching and my extension outreach work are reflected in my research. As I indicated, there's a holism about all of this, and they're all interrelated. And if I look back through my bibliography and research activities, there are some areas I can identify as continuing over a period of many years and some benchmark publications. I think that importantly, in a general kind of way, a fair amount of my research can be thought of as being either applied or the effort to link research to application, or very synoptic, to try to synthesize and pull together disparate pieces that are out there and see if there isn't a multiplier effect of that in conceptualizing or thinking about something. So there's a variety of different things here, and reflecting backwards on it, it's a fairly eclectic mix.
Okay.
But all of it is sort of reflective of my interest in environment and water and land resources and stewardship and institutional arrangements. And so it does add up in my mind to a sensible body of work that has interrelationships. But as I've reflected back on it, there's a lot of different threads. One thing that runs all the way through it is beyond the biophysical and engineering aspects of managing natural resources and the environment. I got very much engaged in looking at the institutional aspects. Institutions in the broadest sense, not just rules and organizational bodies, but informal cultural consensus, rules broadly stated, formal and informal structural arrangements, all of those things are embedded in how we do things, which is the way some people think of institutions. And so I've applied that thinking about the institutional aspects of to lakes, to groundwater, to rivers, on and on to the different things I've done. What are the rules and structures? How does it affect the behavior of people individually and collectively? How do you bring the different tools to bear to achieve planning and management objectives? And so that whole institutional perspective, which is a somewhat different lens, and particularly a different lens for somebody with most of his training in the bio, particularly in the physical sciences, mm-hmm. and the natural sciences. So I see a whole stream of publications and research work on that. In looking back at my bibliography, it starts off with the Lake Project and institutional work related to lake management, but carries on through the years into work done jointly with students on institutional obstacles in lake management, institutional obstacles kinds of things in groundwater management, new directions for lake management, those kinds of things. So you see that pervasive theme really culminating in a huge project done jointly with a number of colleagues. It was called the Institutional Project in our parlance, but it was one of the largest USGS-funded social science projects in history at that time. It took place throughout the late 80s and 90s, involved the training of a whole battery of PhD students who are now scattered all over. My colleagues in that were Frank Gregg, who was the Dean of the School of Renewable Resources at the University of Arizona, Bill Lord, who had been a friend of mine here at UW-Madison, one of the most prominent resource economists in the United States, a brilliant guy, myself, and a guy named Mark Waterstone, a geographer at the University of Arizona, and originally Helen Ingram, a very well-known political scientist in water policy, had been involved on this project. And we really did an enormous amount of thinking about institutional dimensions of water policy. Case studies all over, a lot of different publications came out, a big report. So it was kind of a culminating piece. of my thinking and gave me a whole different framework, although I didn't publish a lot subsequently. But one of my PhD students who worked on that, Rich Marjoram, who's now an associate professor at the University of Oregon, has continued on with some of that work, and the generations of students involved who are scattered all around the University of Colorado and other places have continued that work. So the institutional aspects, I just want to stress, were thematic in this. A lot of stuff along the way on integration, and I start seeing it showing up in my resume in funny ways. Talks at the National Geological Society meetings. I became one of the youngest presidents of the Hydrogeology Division of the Geological Society of America. We had the dominant membership in the GSA. This is many, many years ago when I used to wear a hydrogeologist hat. And I see myself presenting a paper there on the role of hydrogeology in lake management. But over the years, whether it was in energy, fisheries, forestry, whatever kinds of things I was engaged with, my general pitch to the specialist was they are just one of many players, that the whole domain is too important to simply be left to them. So energy was too important to be left to geologists or engineers. Yes. Forestry is way too important to be left to foresters. Fisheries management can't be done just by fisheries biologists. On and on. I've managed to alienate almost every discipline I've ever had to interact with. But the whole theme of integration, of starting to see how the parts come together, shows up in a lot of the practical work, but it comes to a head in some pieces done. A lot of it was happening in this water policy project with Greg and Lord and Waterstone that I mentioned, but in work that I was doing with Rich Marjoram, we published something for DNR called Integrated Environmental Management, Improving the Practice in Wisconsin. That became quite influential within the agency in getting them to think about how you tie all the pieces together instead of a bunch of these little parts managing things. And then a piece while I was on sabbatical at the University of Colorado, I co-taught with one of the giants in natural resources law, a real Renaissance guy named Charles Wilkinson. I sat in his natural resources policy seminar, did a ton of things out there. But they, the law school, of course, is considerably wealthier than the planning department, and gave me a research assistant for some hours each week. And I published a piece towards integrated environmental management, a reconnaissance of state statutes, looking for how much discretionary authority there was in state statutes to move beyond just this narrow functional management and start tying the pieces together, looking at our more holistic ecological management of today. And finally, with my colleague Bill Cinzoni, who I've mentioned before, UW yes. water chemist, published a piece that was quite provocative called Integrated Environmental Management, Strengthening the Conceptualization. It got published in Environmental Management as a forum piece. It's a big piece, 15, 20 pages. And I used the Black Earth Creek experience as an example of trying to pull together some of the pieces once we got past the conceptualization. It's been a highly quoted piece. It was quite controversial in publication. I had a real battle with a guy named Larry Susskind at MIT, who wrote a very scathing critical review of it, which I wrote back an equally critical review, and only did get published. That thing has been extensively quoted. Kind of an interesting piece in terms of thinking about integration. And of course, all along the way, there's a piece that showed up in the Journal of North American Fisheries Management on exceptional waters management. The theme there is integrating the pieces. So that theme is pervasive in research projects and in my work always. But the conceptual aspect of it, what do we mean by integrated environmental management? How do you do it in practice? What are some examples of it? How can we further the cause? We all say we want to do it. How do you do it?
Right.
Has been one of the major struts of my research platform. I indicated, in the area of rivers, I've confessed that I was genetically encoded to be a trout angler.
Yes.
Someplace along the way, there's a displaced DNA code that made me an avid, addicted angler. And so under the guise, I suppose, of river management and river and watershed conservation, I wound up doing some things that spoke to that topic, which were quite interesting. One was a paper I did with Bill Sanzoni and Jeff Mayer, is one of my graduate students, an advisee of mine in the water management program, who subsequently went on. He was a state government reporter here, and now is the president of a website called WisconsinPolitics.com. But we did a piece, and we first published it as an IES paper, and then reworked it, called The Exceptional Waters Approach to Managing Cold Water Resources. And it was one of these integrative kind of things that fisheries managers only had domain over a small number of things and could not affect the land use and all the big ticket items that affected only the fisheries. And that unless they could figure out a synoptic, comprehensive way of dealing on a watershed basis with management of the water and the resources, their fishery stuff is nothing more than puttering. So that was one start. I continued that interest, and of course, at Trout Unlimited, I could spend 1,000 hours talking about what we did nationally at Trout Unlimited, and turning that whole organization around, science-based stuff, the interventions in a broad set of resource areas nationally and internationally and locally. My interest in state planning, since I was a state planning director, and my interest in fisheries and cold water conservation led to a project with a brilliant young PhD student in IES named Simeon Stairs, who I hired to work with me on a project I got some funding for. And we published a piece that came out a couple years ago in Fisheries, and it was a review of cold water fisheries management at the state level in the United States. And it was based on a big empirical survey and interviews and data digestion and so forth, which provided this bird's eye view of how fisheries agencies did their planning and policy development for fisheries management. It was quite interesting. It was useful within the Trout Unlimited context. So just another technical piece, a little subset in the cold water fisheries management area. I should note the exceptional waters approach was adopted by a colleague of mine. I'm now on Trout Unlimited Canada's national board, the National Resources Board, and hired a friend of mine as the national fisheries biologist from the Ministry of Natural Resources in Ontario. But while he was there in the ministry, put into place a whole exceptional waters approach based on our article in Ontario. And so I have this continuing linkage with him. I note these two pieces under the heading of research related to river resources and cold water fisheries management, because out of all that little sidebar of my life came something that was not anything that would meet the stripe of academic research. It was a book we published, a UW Press book, which has been, I'm sure, the most widely read thing I've ever written. Co-authored with Jeff Mayers and Bill Sanzoni and a guy at DNR, Andy Morton, called Exploring Wisconsin Trout Streams, The Angler's Guide. 2 years of research, not one of these Mo and Joe go catch a fish at the rock down here and use this kind of a worm or whatever. It was an attempt to place Wisconsin in the larger setting of its contributions to the literature of trout fishing, the science of trout fishing, the industry of trout fishing, the development of innovative approaches, who were kind of the leaders over time, and then every chapter in the book that deals with a fishing story or some river system also deals with a conservation vignette. And I set the tempo in that book with what I think is a quite good introduction for the layperson into water resources management and planning, the history thereof in Wisconsin. That book has been one of the biggest regional sellers for UW Press. Now I think it's close to being out of print, and I'm too lazy to go back and revise it. It's got lots of fun fishing stuff in it. But it was interesting to me that this little popularized book, which has gotten wide coinage, and I could have gone on the circuit, and I do a little bit of this, talking about being a wise guy fisherman, and just use that book as a springboard for that. But we really wanted to tell this bigger historical, contextual, resource management story to the angling community, of which there's 150,000 trout anglers in the state, give or take a few.
In an earlier conversation, I think you suggested to me that this book, The Angler's Guide mm-hmm. to Wisconsin Fishing, was perhaps your most significant publication.
Well, it's certainly, it's of localized consequence. It didn't have a big national audience, but it certainly had a lot of readers. And we get the feedback from these people. This is not how do I tie this fly, how do I fish this situation, what do you use on this stream in the fall or the spring or whatever, mm-hmm. the normal fishing jargon that goes into it. This was sort of a seminal book that you could read and reread that placed this whole thing in context. We'd gone, it was a 2-year research effort through the archives and the role of Aldo Leopold and great writers. So it really tried to put Wisconsin on the map in a universe where, for the most part, the Midwest is flyover country. There's bicoastal orientation. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about economy, politics, or trout fishing. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew about these magic Midwestern resources and contributions. And so in that regard, in this little niche, it was a rewarding thing to do. And I suspect we haven't made $1,000 or $2,000 a piece out of the whole effort over time. But it's a good piece of work, and I wouldn't hesitate to recommend it to anybody.
But what is perhaps significant about it is the popular embrace of some synthesized thinking about the environment and water in particular.
Yeah. And there's stuff in there, there's attempts to inject water chemistry and watershed management, and citizen stewardship, and issues about public land acquisition are just embedded throughout that book.
And that takes me back to a comment that your colleague Jerry Kaufman said about you, and he told me to underline it, that you were a very savvy guy about understanding how to take knowledge and put it to use.
Well, I think I've done all right in that area, but it's part of my whole extension, outreach applications, work at Pyramid Lake, Nevada. My dissertation playing a role in how to apply it in the whole context of interstate water allocation. Uh-huh. So I've always done it, and over a period of time, I suppose you learn and get better at it. But I've been able to do it pretty well, I think. That actually raises a little separate area of research I wasn't going to mention, but after I came back to the university from state government, I wound up working with National Science Foundation on a project called the State Science Engineering Technology Project, which was really interested in the whole subject of how university-based research in the area of science and technology got transferred for public decision-making into state government.
Ah.
I was a principal in that. I did there's a publication someplace on Wisconsin case examples of that, including, interestingly, the Kickapoo, for example. I use as an example with one of my students, pulled that together. He's now the Associate Dean for Research down at the University of Texas. But in any event, this whole business of, you raised the point of how do you translate information, I got sort of interested in these issues. It's not just an extension education issue. Someplace along the line I wrote something in the Extension Journal on energy in the trenches, or the energy crisis in the trenches. How do you capitalize on this teachable moment to educate people about energy supply, energy demand, energy conservation, constraints, blah, blah, blah. And so I've always been doing that, but in a couple of different areas I actually have done some research on it, and the State Science and project with NSF gave me an overview nationally of how innovation diffusion took place from the universities into government, whether or not it was with law enforcement agencies and communication systems, or whether or not it was in toxic regulations, whatever it happened to be. So, and I worked there with a guy named Bert Wakely, a guy I've maintained a lifelong relationship with, who I met during my state planning days, but he had worked for Bill Clinton in Arkansas, went up to be John Sununu's chief of staff when Sununu was governor, and that didn't last so long. Bert was in charge of this project with another guy from NSF, Bert had worked for NGA, the National Governors Association.
Okay.
And when he finally cashed out of that sector, he wound up working for one of the computer companies in applications for government. But I've maintained a long-standing linkage with him in terms of the whole policy development and planning process at the state level and how innovation comes about at the state. And during that period, both in the university and in state government, I worked with the Council of State Governments, National Council of State Legislatures, NGA, federal agencies, examining that problem, particularly as I got increasingly convinced that the states were a particularly important fulcrum, linchpoint in the federalist system. These are the days when we were decentralizing, Reagan was opting out of any federal responsibilities. States were indeed laboratories and incubators of ideas. Wisconsin had been the genesis for all kinds of fresh thinking in the social sciences and other areas over the years. So the states really interested me as a place where things could happen and still do, as you could see by me looking at the state level planning for cold water fisheries. I just kept moving the boxes around, looking at things through different perspectives and trying to bring accumulated knowledge I'd gotten in other realms to bear on a somewhat different topic with the hope that that might produce some different insights than another researcher might have been able to chase. And then another piece of this sort of communication link that you talked about was a piece I did, Bud Jordahl and I co-authored a piece on the Wisconsin idea in a publication that was done here for what is now the La Follette Institute, honoring Carl Runge upon his retirement from the university. I still think it's a darn seminal piece looking at different mechanisms by which university expertise is transferred into the state policy-making machinery. And
is that the essential truth of the Wisconsin idea?
I wouldn't say it's the truth. I would say it was an honest elaboration or description of some of the mechanisms by which we transfer research results, ranging from structured arrangements to do it, to transferring in under contract research models of information, to moving our students into positions in state government. That was really one of the most direct applications of the Wisconsin idea.
Yes.
And it was a good typology and a good framing of it. There's been a lot of other things that have been done by good colleagues like Bill Cronin and others. And of course, the early work on the Wisconsin idea has always, I took some time to read that literature. But this was just another one of these areas where, is it a research area? Not a prominent research area for me, but I certainly at least have written a piece on the Wisconsin idea, on the public service. There's another piece I did a long time ago on the public service roles of universities, of state universities, that link to that theme that you noted about converting what we do in terms of knowledge production and research thinking into application, including in kind of the new era of adaptive management. How do you actually do that? What can universities really contribute?
Mm-hmm.
If there's so much uncertainty, the data is dirty, how do you work with citizen groups and governmental agencies to set some boundaries and devise some experiments so that we can keep moving the human enterprise forward and learn from our slip-ups? And of course, one of the things that is now a mainstay of a lot of my speeches, coming back to my institutional interest, and I carry this out when I deal with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency or any other group, we don't allow for failure, and failure is how we learn. And I would contend that we need to design our institutions so that they're willing to innovate and try things, and that we can accept failure, that we structure it so that we learn from the failure and make the corrections. But instead, what's happened in this increasingly bitter and divided kind of political environment we live in, as soon as there's any kind of failure, it becomes a newspaper headline and heads roll. So the idea of not being willing to innovate and try new things, whether it's in watershed management or fisheries management or in social programs or the building of cities, we have to understand almost everything we do is experimental. We don't know the consequences of these interventions, that the learned community and the research community can put some boundaries on and can help monitor in a rational way what's going on, suggest some ideas on the next intervention. And so that whole thing of the role of science in public policy making and kind of a broad institutional feeling for how this comes about is important. It leads just thinking again about research stuff, and almost everything I've done, I can go back and find the roots of this stuff in some early publications, but there's been a number of publications in goofy outlets, actually, over the last 10, 15 years that have made me one of the more knowledgeable people, I would suppose, in the United States, maybe the world, on the watershed partnerships and the whole business of collaborative watershed management. And I started off working with River Network. Well, actually, I'd done a lot here working with one example, building the River Alliance of Wisconsin, community-based watershed partnerships, blah, 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 and extending that. But then we did something called the Four Corners Project, which got a lot of national recognition, funded by the Kendall Foundation, and a very interesting guy named Ted Smith, who had done a lot of interesting philanthropy and is now the executive director of the Kendall Foundation in New England. And we worked through River Network and brought together principal policymakers, players, practitioners, in what were called the Four Corners. We did Washington, Florida, California, and Massachusetts as states, traveled around, took these busy people there, and then I wrote with one of my PhD students, but I did most of the work on that, the final report, the Four Corners Project report, to make sure it was captured, plus a lot of stuff. I wound up being the facilitator and blah, blah, blah. That was very useful. That thing got a lot of run. I had to push the people at River Network to really get this out and get it published. The next step was the National Academy for Public Administration put out request for proposals, and they were looking at environmental innovation in the next century. And I wound up in a coterie. We were successful. Who worked with me on that? Ken Jensko, one of my PhD students, now is the head and extension for watershed management education, and has just taken on a joint appointment at the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. So to some degree, he's following in my footsteps. Huh. Ken worked with me on this project with the National Academy of Public Administration, in which we looked at watershed experiences in a variety of states and pulled that together into and it's a part of their volume on this through the National Academy. But in that is not only a kind of a seminal statement framing out the new watershed movement, but it's the clearest outline of my evaluation approach, which has evolved over 30 years. And again, I want to now talk just a little bit, because evaluation became kind of a hallmark of how do you evaluate these kinds of things?
Yeah.
And how do you move beyond the green eye shades guy perspective on these things? And how, because you're in the public sector, in a public arena, how do you manage to go beyond simply the metrics that legislators could say, okay, that's good, you did that or didn't do that? How about some of the social capital building ideas and information availability ideas and creating new capacities out in the non-governmental world? How do you build that in? But I started looking at evaluation, as I said earlier, when I was finishing off the Lake Project. I certainly looked at evaluation when I was in state government. In fact, a huge flashpoint for the Lucy administration, when I worked for Governor Lucy, was over the subject of regional planning. And in fact, it's a, nobody talks about it much now, but at that time they got more than 200,000 signatures on a recall petition by the far right, arguing that regional planning was something orchestrated by the UN, and Lucy was a part of it, was the John Birch Society and so forth. And we actually published, when I came back to the university, because I didn't want to lose it, a private paper that we had done for the governor on regional planning, an executive summary and recommendations, and that was another evaluative effort. What did we really accomplish in regional planning? I did some stuff on something we did for public environmental education, environmental management strategies, managing Wisconsin's environment, the people resources relationship, but I did the piece on planning and evaluation. I had done some evaluation in some of the international work I had done. It's been 4 or 5 years. That's a whole separate component I haven't talked about. In Tunisia, and particularly in Thailand, doing subnational planning there. But some evaluation was built into that. Evaluation was built into these task forces, an extension on water resources, groundwater. Evaluation was built into looking at the performance of a chancellor in extension. And so I was starting to develop a kind of a feeling for how do you do evaluation? What do you look for? How do you evaluate institutional arrangements? And in 1988, I did a piece with Al Miller, who worked here at Sea Grant, but had worked with me, had been one of my executive officers in state government and one of the co-architects of the state coastal management program. And we did a piece called Assessing Network Coastal Zone Management Programs. It was published in the Journal of Coastal Zone Management. That was a real bellwether publication in two ways. One, it talked about, it was an early on recognition that you're not going to get new dominant top-down agencies in a culture that was starting to flatten out.
Can
so
you?
Al Miller and I did this piece, Assessing Network Coastal Zone Management Programs, and as I was saying, it did two things. Outlined kind of this framework for what we meant by networking. You weren't going to create new dominant centralized authorities, regulatory agencies. You had to work with the pieces you had and get them to work in concert under in some kind of a either planned framework and consultation arrangement to carry out work which was collective in nature. And so this was an outgrowth of stuff I'd been doing over time, building partnerships, coordinating. This network program was the first network program approved by NOAA, the National Office of Atmospheric Oceanic Administration and so forth, coastal programs, and we talked about that nationally, and there were other network programs and how they work. But we also put in place, and I did it again with one of my water policy workshops, and Al worked with me on it, a whole framework for evaluating these networked programs. And that was a seminal piece that got extensive quotes. There hadn't been much work done evaluating these programs. And that put into place some things on a framework. And
can you date that for us?
That was in 1988 that it was published.
Okay.
But I had also been talking then at conferences on everything from pesticide regulation, evaluating pesticide regulation programs, to all these things I was doing had evaluative components. So I got familiar with kind of that literature, and I think probably then the best piece that I had anything to do with in the evaluation arena was this piece that was published by the National Academy in 2000, I guess it was, 1999, Exploring Watershed Approach, 2000 that was published, an Empirical Assessment of Innovation and Environmental Management. Very good statement. But then I reverted to my extension mode and convened. I got some money from Ted Kendall at the Ted Smith at the Kendall Foundation to pull together 10 or 12 of the best researchers in watersheds and try to define what were really the problems, the research questions, where were we, a definitive statement. And out of that, we produced about 4,000 or 5,000 of these little publications, non-refereed piece, and it was called, Toward Understanding New Watershed Initiatives, a report from the Madison Watershed Workshop. And I distributed widely. I kind of developed this notion of how you get into the state agencies and the academic stuff and the federal agencies. Well, that thing has gotten picked up just all over, and it became part of me getting engaged with EPA and redirecting their watershed program. It led to Ken and I doing a piece in some of the German literature and why I was invited over to the EU to talk about watershed management there. So all kinds of different outlets, and that's one thing. I've published in some of the goofiest places, some refereed, some non-refereed, some proceedings things, some in-house organ things, and lots of stuff. Some stuff probably is lost in my bibliography. But even to where late in the game in my water-related work, I was a party to publishing the final report of the waters of Wisconsin and a subsequent publication And I wrote a fair amount of that, although Kurt Miney, a good colleague of mine, was the director, the editor, the driving force. But I actually, in looking back, wrote a fair amount of parts of that report. That's another one of these kinds of pieces that has, you know, what kind of an outlet is that? Through the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters. It's a little localized thing. You might not see it on the larger screen of things, but it was an important kind of publication, in fact, recognized in other states as an interesting approach to grappling with water resources. And I think I just make the point in passing that I've sure published in some goofy outlets, and as you can see from things I've said earlier, a lot of things have shown up first as classroom efforts, an extension report translated into a revised journal publication, maybe a policy piece for state government or beyond. So lots of stuff like that.
Steve, you said early on in the interview, in the first interview session actually, that one thing that you did was use your students to develop policy papers that went on to be published or became policy.
Right.
And I had no reason not to believe you, but sitting at this point in the interview with you, you have said that over and over and over again.
Yep.
Really did do that.
It goes back to the Inland Lake days, the Chippewa flowage investigations. That work done by, couldn't have happened without a team of graduate students. I think we had 30 graduate students working with us. We did the kind of land tenure on Indian land conversions up there. What happened with the BIA, traced through censures of the director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs for the way land transactions were handled. We had the only picture. You'd like to think the federal agency, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, would have that. They didn't. And so students did that. Students working on that did that. Students did the hydrologic modeling. All of it under the direction of a team of professionals.
Right.
There were a lot of people engaged in that. But when I sat up there like a wise guy in Washington holding forth for 3 days, being cross-examined and so forth by the utility industry and by our State Department of Justice and entering our records on the Chippewa flowage case, all that was essentially my overview of the work done by this workshop and the array of professionals involved in that. That's one demarcation point. We had so many students involved in different parts of the Lake Project who have gone on to amazing careers as presidents of their own consulting firm and so forth, and I can find them in these places. I look back, I carried that same sort of student model into my state planning days, where people hired to do little pieces for the summer went on to become the mayor of Eugene, Oregon, professor at the University of Illinois, just all kinds of, so embedding students and using student outputs and trying to then put some quality controls on raw student work and use it in a wider forum has been an important piece of the game for me. And so many different things, from looking at the groundwater stuff, the watershed stuff, Chippewa flowage, the Black Earth Creek Initiative, coastal zone management evaluation, institutional assessment. Students played a very prominent role in doing all that. And I see, here's another piece that at one time we were trying to take over the American Water Resources Association and upgrade that poor body that was a multidisciplinary body, but we thought had been captured by the U.S. Geological Survey and kind of the technocrats. And so the people I've mentioned, Waterstone and Lord and other ne'er-do-wells, were trying to kind of reorient them. We set up a major national policy forum on redefining national water policy. I put together a whole session, new roles and directions, with the states as a linchpin and kind of a framework for thinking about how we develop national water policy. That got published as a AWRA special paper in 1989, and yet that was a seminal piece of work and connected me with a whole set of people who were doing innovative work in South Florida and Nebraska and other places, which is how this sort of repository of knowledge I sit on about different approaches to water management, I've wound up engaged in all these places, either as a consultant or working with them or studying them or one thing or another. So it's all part of the kind of tapestry of what you're doing. Of course, some publications are, here's one, by Bourne, Harvey Jacobs, some other colleagues, Future Issues Facing Wisconsin's Land Resources, an IES report. This is a 1990 publication dealing with the land use questions.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the big land questions we face? And I've been working with land use in one way or another, watersheds are just an extension of that, all my life. And so I think when you look at all that, you see a lot of different threads that are interwoven substantively in the sense of different facets of the water cycle, groundwater, rivers, lakes, oceans, whatever it happens to be, the biotic components, the fisheries and so forth, the land resource base. I've also served a stint as chair of the Governor's Forest Productivity Committee and worked with the university on research initiatives in forestry. So the forest resource, all those things are there, along with these themes about integrated management, the role of science, coordination, partnerships and collaborative community-based planning and management. All those things transect everything so that at the end of the day, it's a whole body of research, but in a lot of sort of diffuse areas. And the research is of variable quality. Some of it's quite popularized. Some of it is in an outreach mode. Some of it is basic empirical work. Some of it is just with the natural resource issues, the hydrogeology of the things. So there's a lot of different pieces. And so it's kind of eclectic, Bob.
But there does seem to be a unifying theme in that you always seem to be asking the larger question on whichever aspect of the physical world you happen to be addressing, whether it's lakes, land use, groundwater.
Whatever. And the same thing is true. During my stint as state planning director, I still stayed involved with the university and taught at a state policy seminar. And there was work that got published that was the result of either student papers, but a lot of work that took me away from the resource area. I just made a conscious decision not to publish, much to the chagrin of some of my mentors and colleagues like Bud Jordahl, who thinks I should and still should do a book on state planning and state policy making and the Wisconsin experience, because it is a rich one, and I'm probably in control of that information as much as anybody in the world right now. But I went off on another tangent, and I decided I wanted more experience in the international realm at that point. We just brought in $1 million project from USAID on decentralized planning, and we're working all over the world, led to conferences in Tanzania, and got me a chance to have some in-depth exposure in Tunisia and in Thailand, where I looked very carefully at the provincial planning, was able to use my experience in both the university and state government to really dissect and understand and connect with counterparts over there in ways that other academics were less comfortable with. I mean, somebody who was a governor of a province in Thailand could talk to me with no problem at all about governance issues, even though the arrangements were structurally different and mm-hmm. what have you, because I was just very conversant and familiar with those issues. So I did a couple of papers there that were published, that were sort of the regional planning theme with Ved Prakash, one of my key colleagues, and Leo Jacobson in the international arena. Besides the reports we did, there was one on provincial planning in Thailand. It's a very good paper, actually, on the efficacy of decentralized planning. And I have not done the seminal piece that I might have done on regional planning along the way. I certainly spent a lifetime dealing with all the issues that transcend artificial governmental and jurisdictional boundaries. And who knows, maybe I'll yet get around to doing that. But it's picked up in one way or another in a lot of these pieces I've done. So by hook or crook, I got to some of the stuff I wanted to get to.
A truly wide range of interests. Almost incredibly wide range.
Well, I never felt like C.P. Snow. I didn't have the reach into the humanities and the arts that other people exhibit, and some of the great minds of our time seem to move adroitly back. And I was struck by Charles Wilkinson when he and I became friends at the University of Colorado, how prolific he was as a book author and how he was able to move between these sort of the chasm between the humanities and arts and social sciences and the biophysical sciences. And I never liked the idea of hard versus soft science, because what could be harder than working with understanding people and understanding the arts and so forth? That's obviously false. But he had such dexterity, and I've met other people that had this ability to transcend these things. I've had an appreciation for it, but limited. And I think one thing the Waters of Wisconsin Project did, I mean, I was intent, as you may recall, upon one, making sure that what we did had practical applications, that we were media sensitive as we went, that highly sympathetic and supportive of the links with the arts and the passion,
correct,
the things that fuel people to act.
Mm-hmm.
And but the same thing would be true if you were organizing a union or trying to get a law passed. And probably some of that background came into play in some subliminal way.
Absolutely. Moving into the next section of the interview with Professor Bourne, I'll ask Steve for some comments on his experience with UW-Madison administration. Steve?
Well, this is obviously a riskier part of the historical record, and I don't pretend to have been close to all the machinations and details of the problems of deans and provosts and what have you. So all I can offer is some selected insights that might be of some use. I have dealt on the Madison campus with a couple of different deans in LNS and with a couple of different deans and associate deans in CALS, because as I indicated earlier, the Department of Urban and Regional Planning
mm-hmm.
merged and became a bi-college department,
mm-hmm.
which was a real institutional innovation. In doing that, there was support in both camps, and I think Phil Certain was just a top-notch dean while he was here. He and I had our run-ins, and as I say, he was the one that did the execution of docking my salary for having the hubris to challenge the extension deans and administrators. But I had a very respectful relationship with him, even where we disagreed. Dave Cronin was his predecessor, and I like Dave very much. I think that dean of LNS is a tough job situation. I think in both their cases, things changed over a period of 20 years with the role of associate deans. Mary Ann Fitzpatrick was one we worked closely with. The role of the associate deans became a lot greater when they came into being, rather than having the direct interface with deans, which used to be the case. They created a whole tier of associate deans to deal with the physical sciences, the social sciences, and so forth, because the job just became too overwhelming as dean of a huge complex in LNS. In general, it seems to me that on the LNS side of the thing, bright, capable deans dealing with complicated problems, but a department like urban and regional planning, for example, was always a just small change for them. We don't fit the template of what the university was about in their LNS eyes. We were graduate, we were interdisciplinary, we were professional, we were small, did a lot of applied things, and none of that really captured their interest, even though if you looked at any of the kind of strategic plans that talked about Wisconsin idea, public service, participatory learning, international kinds of stuff, because we were moving in that direction, we were doing a lot of that stuff, but the support from the deans was pretty minimal. And now, it may have been true across the campus, there were some tight times and belt tightening, but there was never a dean that had the insight to say, hey, this is a program that's really doing a lot of stuff, it's got a lot of visibility, people talk about the faculty, students are out there doing things. Yes, it's not the sociology department, it's not genetics, but it's something different, and it's valuable, and it's part of what this university is about. Let's do something to get them out of those 10th rate quarters they're in, the 50th rate support, the nickel and diming in terms of supplies and staffing and phone calls and all this stuff. let's really help them with a couple staff. Let's help them in a new building location. And there have been stops and starts where there's a little help in that, but for the most part, I think I'd be kidding myself if I said they ever really understood and supported the department. Now, a lot of academics in mainline disciplines, you know, what's planning, what kind of work is this, what kind of research is this, it didn't fit the normal mold. It's much more in the service learning kind of tradition. You can see a lot of the stuff I did with students along the way was a different kind of learning. Now the students, I think if you talk to the students and see where the students are, this turns out to have been a pretty good educational model.
Yes.
We didn't have an undergraduate program, which clearly hurt, and that was never going to happen with geography there, and even though we've talked about it a time or two. But the LNS deans, and particularly as the budget tightened up, we got just marginal treatment, and we took a couple of hits in terms of evaluations. I've indicated earlier some of the issues in terms of our efforts to recruit minority students.
Right.
And at some point when government was being eviscerated from the Reagan and Thompson days on forward, lots of sources of support for planning-related research just went away.
Yes.
And you had to be cognizant of that and sympathetic. Now, the deans argued, and I think in some cases were protective of keeping the department above critical accreditation levels, and were a little sensitive. I think I have a high regard for Phil Sutton, in spite of battles here and there with him. I just think he's an eminently decent guy and a very good administrator and smart about the business of the college in tough times. But I don't think we ever got the support, nor do I think that the Institute for Environmental Studies, another interdisciplinary effort which I had a lifetime of involvement with, and might have been, had Ward not been chancellor, I would have been director of the Institute for Environmental Studies and made that kind of administrative commitment for 5 or 8 years or whatever to the campus. But that was lip service support. And it wasn't, and it's ironic to me to see we have a new person who's come in as the director. They spent a year and a half recruiting her, and she's very good. She's come in from outside, but they've spent, I don't know, $1 million refurbishing buildings and so forth. Nobody from the inside would ever get that kind of treatment. And it's like when I interviewed for Dean of the College of Natural Resources at the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
Met by limousines, put up in great quarters, run around. But here, you're a local boy, you're trapped here. There's just absolutely, and I think there's a tendency to be assuming about our people who are here and want to be in Wisconsin for the long term. Obviously, if it's a stem cell biotechnologist, they'll fight hard to keep them here.
Yeah.
A prominent poet. I mean, we do our job on these competitive things. In these mushier areas, though, policy planning area, and I think the La Follette people would share some of the same ideas, and I used to have a lot of working relationships with La Follette, as did Erpel, that there's a lot more lip service on the part of the deans to these sort of in-between-the-cracks interdisciplinary units that could be the leading edge of how universities organize and deliver. And in fact, I think the model of the Institute for Environmental Studies, a lot of volunteer faculty, ad hoc arrangements, almost a Tofflerian ability to rearray the blocks around particular problems and research enterprises, could be a pretty good model, but never really supported. Lots of words, but not the big money. Now, maybe we've always been the victim of tight financial circumstances, and departments are sort of the core enterprise intellectually on this campus, and it makes it very, very difficult. And at the end of the day, your evaluations and so forth happen through your home departments, not through the areas where you voluntarily said, let's work in the Institute on these shared programs and so forth. So it's a very tough tracking mechanism for them. So that's my take on the LNS deans. And in some cases, it's just been a total lack of understanding or sympathy or support. Now, it's been hard to keep the ship alive, and we've done so sometimes, but very little help from that office. When Marianne Fitzpatrick was the associate dean, she probably had the longest run, and reasonably collaborative, not many more resources available. I know she expected to become the dean after she'd been in the ranks of the deputy dean for a while, and when she didn't get that deanship, she's now left and gone to South Carolina. While some people may have found her to be an imperial dean, she was reasonably fair to us within the constraints of what she could do. And where personnel issues came up and vexing issues, I thought those offices were helpful. Aberley, and particularly his deputy dean, who has now left and gone to Berkeley as a dean, Paul Ludden, terrific guys. All those people in Cal's were fabulous to work with. And as a merged department, maybe it was because Cal's was aggrandizing and seeing something beyond the cash cows of biotech and molecular biology or traditional ag production stuff. ERPA was doing a lot of things, and the food systems work. Opened up new avenues to new constituencies, our work in land use planning and resources, a whole other dimension. And they could really see the value because they have a tradition of application, much more hierarchical. Those guys were as supportive as they could be. And in things like budget reconciliation and trying to have a facile arrangement between two colleges for a bi-college department, I think I can only say that Cal's was always considerably more facilitative than LNS, and that both of those colleges would have profited from a lecture from me in coordination.
Uh-huh.
So it was a nice model for the chair. Basically, it winds up as being double administrative duty. It's just a double on everything, from faculty meetings with the deans to evaluation. It was very, very hard to catalyze, and we had to take the lead on kind of joint efforts. The grad school, I think I indicated some of the difficulties earlier I had with Dave Ward when he was there.
You just alluded to it, okay. But you said you would speak to it when you talked about David Ward as chancellor.
Okay. I'll talk about David first as the graduate school dean. And, of course, the graduate school has oversight responsibilities on the urban regional planning program as a graduate program. And I suspect that their view, we weren't bringing in multi-million-dollar research contracts, so they may have had some view that this was a weaker department. He came out of geography roots, and geography with their own identity crisis looked askance, I think, at some of the planning activities. But in particular, David is a very smart guy. As dean of the graduate school, had to kind of oversee the quality of the graduate student body. And saw in ERPL some people we were letting in on probation, some people were coming in with less than stellar GPAs and GREs.
Uh-huh.
And it grew out of a set of forces. One was our effort to treat individuals as individuals. People don't get born into planning like they get born into music or geology.
Mm-hmm.
What is planning? People late in life discover we have people who have been out for 15 or 20 years with a lot of scar tissue from life accumulated who come back and say, gee, this planning thing looks like a chance to work in a forward kind of vein and pick some areas that matter to me. So we have people that you couldn't hold them culpable in my mind for what they did when they were 18, 19, and 20. They're now 40 years old with a whole different set of life experiences and moving in channels that were not traditional university experiences. And we tried to be very careful in reviewing these kinds of files and interviewing people. So we put people up, unless you understood the people inside the Manila folder. We're questionable people in terms of being put up for admission. So that raised a flag. We were also trying to build, it was so critical for a planning department, still is a critical need, to try to get students of color. Mm-hmm. There, who would go forth and work in their communities and urban areas and so forth and have a much stronger presence than we could otherwise. And in reaching out to places where there might be minority populations, it was very difficult to bring in students with strong GREs, mm-hmm. and for whatever sets of reasons. And so I remember in particular one altercation, phone conversation with the graduate school and David, about our GPAs and the number of people coming in. Now, we were probably stressed on enrollments at that time, too, because there had been these huge cutbacks by Reagan and planning, and why would you ever plan or look ahead, and the private sector will do it all, and this and that, and why would we have all these support programs for, and what role does the national government have in shaping cities, and so everything was sort of eroding underneath us, and so we probably were reaching down a little bit in the caliber of students just to maintain viable populations. But we had these other forces going on, and it was a hard case to explain what we were about, because they really didn't give a damn what we were about. This is totally untrue of Martin Cadwalader, who had been an associate faculty of ours, very sympathetic to the problems, even where he can't do anything, to the problems of small departments and resources and admissions and staffing, and he's been a joy to work with. Now, when Ward went on to become, first he was provost and then chancellor, I wound up, as I indicated, I was the top choice of the search and screen committee for the IES directorship, and the last thing David Ward wanted was me. And my interview with him was an absolute sham. He didn't ask me anything academic. In fact, I don't think he spent 5 minutes with me. He was busy with something else, and they hired somebody else, a good guy. The Institute would have probably gone a different direction with different energy levels, but it's also pretty clear that I was not a guy that would be easily managed and manipulated. I had my own networks and access to power seats and so forth, and would be committed to really getting some things done. I think it was another expression of not wanting to find additional demands for money from the interdisciplinary realm, you know, and I would be a lot of pressure and probably a stronger presence there.
And this was when, Steve? Give me a year here.
No, I'm reaching a little bit. 1985 or 90, I can't quite remember. Good guy, Tom Ewell, was hired, and Ward said he wanted two names sent to him. I know this all secondhand from the committee and so forth. And I wrote a very lengthy letter. I was urged to apply, and I wrote a letter, four or five pages, that the letter itself could have been used to disqualify me, because I pointed out all the pitfalls of interdisciplinary education. I knew a great deal about.
During the interview on July 6, 2005, with Professor Stephen Bourne, talking about his relations with, at this point, Chancellor David Ward.
So there was some residual hostility with Ward as a result of my encounters as chair, and he is dean of graduate school, and I suspect on this IES thing, I think our personality styles, he was a man small in stature, I'm a big presence. He's sort of the British intellect, the British geographer in the classic sense, a very fine scholar. But as chancellor, I think David did a far better job than I might have imagined, and he wound up asking me to do a couple different things on some town and gown committees and the land use committee, and if I had needed to talk to him about anything, I probably could have. But one of the few administrative jobs that I would have considered here, I had no interest ever in being a dean, or I also wound up as one of three finalists for extension chancellor at a different point in time. I had zero interest in that job. That was something else. But the IES directorship I would have taken under the right circumstances. And Ward absolutely trivialized both the interview and all the rest of it, in spite of the fact that I had great support on the committee and elsewhere. But there are different choices to be made. I don't fault the choice in the end. If he was more comfortable with Ewell, he wanted his people in there, and Tom's a good guy and a good friend of mine, and did a credible job. I would have done a different job. And it's just I brought the kind of energy to so many different kinds of enterprises and built them that it's hard to say what IES would look like under my leadership. On the other hand, I wouldn't have tolerated the kind of historic neglect and nickel and dime support for these kinds of enterprises, and that probably would have become a point of some abrasion. But on balance, I think Ward did a surprisingly good job as chancellor, and has gone on to his own accolades, and was a strong voice for the faculty, and in the end, a pretty good voice with regard to IES, and appreciated some of the people in the planning department, like Jerry Kaufman and other people, for the work they did. So that's okay. Dave understood the faculty. He really did understand the faculty. Unlike his predecessor, Donna Shalala, who he worked for, who was, when Shalala came here, we knew of Shalala because she'd been at Hunter and with Jeannie Birch, who was a very prominent person in the planning business, and Shalala herself was a bit of a planner, obviously policy person, and she was a very imperious kind of figure. For a small woman, very, very powerful, knew what the hell she wanted to do. And if she had one great deficiency in my mind, it's that she didn't understand that that the pronouns came in more than simply the first person singular. That there was a first person plural called we. And she was all about I. I mean, I think Donna Shalala is an egomaniac, and I think she could be very dismissive of almost anybody. When she was done talking with you, she was done. It's like you became invisible. I only had a few meetings with her. I knew, you know, not a lot of interaction. Having said that, I also think she was one of the most able chancellors this place had at a critical time, and I am still struck. I have the very highest regard, unlike a lot of people, yes, for the job she did here. She came in to ruffle the old boys network, there is no doubt about it. And like a true executive, like Dave Cronin, I don't think was ever able to do, she picked five or six targets that were going to be priorities, and she stayed on message for the period of time she was here. It was never, at least I never thought that she was here for a lifetime appointment. She was networked. I knew a bunch of people on her staff. She was talking with Hillary Clinton and the Clinton people every other day or more. She was networked. She was a consummate networker, and she knew everybody, and they knew her, whether it was Desmond Tutu or Hillary Clinton or whoever. And she was upwardly mobile. That was clear. That's fine. For the period of time she was here, she set a set of targets in place, and she executed them. She recognized that the athletic department was in chaos, and that the athletic department had a strong linkage to fundraising here. And she made the kinds of bold decisions, dumped the athletic department director and football coaches and hiring and so forth. And unbeknownst to most people I know, that she met with most women recruits that came in, she met with other high-profile recruits. I don't think she ever slept. I mean, she just did all these little behind-the-scenes things that you don't know. So in that whole thing, and linking it to the fundraising effort, we were a nickel and dime operation through our foundation. She saw a whole set of linkages and way to build fundraising at a public university to where this foundation is a cash cow, $1.5 billion capital campaign. Every 5 years, at least $400 million comes over the counter. Regardless of what we do now, there's the whole spirit of giving. We're in a public university endowment situation that seems quite remarkable. And none of that existed before Shalala. She went out and worked with all kinds of constituencies, alumni, found different kinds of ways to make those connections. So in fundraising, in recognizing the importance of the athletic department as a symbolism for the university, forget the fact that it can undergird, undercut what universities are really about, can be a very negative factor within universities. She saw the high end of it and how to do it. She oversaw, in ruthless manner, the changing of the garden. I know she got rid of some deans, including some people I may have mentioned along the way, and it was done ruthlessly. But she knew how to make those changes systemically in personnel. Almost, it wasn't as bad as Henry Ford, where reportedly you'd come into the office and the old man Ford would be in there with an axe chopping up your desk. That was a fairly clear signal. But she wasn't a lot more subtle than that. And a lot of people moved on to other kinds of venues. She was also a great mentor to people, but turning over the middle-upper leadership of the University of Wisconsin was a huge accomplishment.
Steve, were you a supporter of hers while she was here?
Even as abrasive as she was. For example, she went to speak at, I think it was the 150th anniversary, maybe, of the College of Agriculture. And you would think that the accolades would be for all the people that went before, all the people that are there now, the great intellectual ideas that we as a university community. And it was I, and very alienating. And I understand why a lot of old deans and associate deans and faculty have been there a long time. We're not happy about hearing that. But yes, I was a supporter. And here's another reason why. In terms of the university getting resources, Donna Shalala got the job done. Whatever I thought of her and the very limited exposure I had with her personally, when she went down to the legislature, I never had to stop and think that I had an inferior representative down there. I knew that the person I had down there was smarter than anybody she was talking to, tougher than anybody she was talking to, well-equipped, and she was a stellar representative. They were delighted. They treated her, even in the normal tense interaction between state government and the university, she was a celebrity figure when she came down. And she carried a lot of weight and a lot of stature, and she represented the university and brought home the bacon. So that's a whole other kind of thing. At the end of the day, I've got to say something positive about that. Now, there were people who thought her initiatives with regard to diversity and with regard to improving the undergraduate climate in the universities were two big initiatives of hers, were a bit of a ruse. But I'll tell you what, when we were recruiting, for example, we had a black woman, PhD from MIT, eminently terrific scholar, great potential and so forth. And there are very few of these people available to us, and we were recruiting her for a faculty position. I took her up to see Shalala, and Shalala put aside everything and spent an hour and a half with her and was prepared. I mean, this was the commitment to finding top-notch black women scholars, for example, in our program. Made commitments about what would be available in the summer in terms of great support from federal agencies and stuff. Heard her out in terms of her personal concerns. Now, the woman didn't come for reasons that were very, very clear. I like this woman very much. Too small of a black community here. She was a single, straight woman who didn't think she'd be able to find a social life in this community. I mean, she was being asked by Andrew Young to come back to the community in Georgia where she could really contribute. I mean, there were other players. I mean, yeah. Shalala's a heavyweight, but so's Andy Young weighing in with a young faculty member.
Yeah.
And but Shalala went on the line. So just as I had heard vicariously from people on her staff who I knew well, that she met with these athletes that Alvarez was recruiting and women athletes and all this stuff that you don't see normally a chancellor dropping down to do. She did a lot of that stuff, and there's probably a ton of stuff I didn't see. Did I not like her, the fact that she turned the press relations office of the university into a Donna Shalala ego magnifying operation? Everything was Shalala, it goes on and on. She was there at football games. She was parachuted in to get visibility. And when Clinton got elected and she went off to be HNSS secretary, no surprise. But for her tenure here, the 5 or 6 years, dismissive as she may have been, as imperious and distant as she may have been, as threatening as she may have been to some people here, on a major set of metrics, I think she did wonderful things at a critical juncture for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she wouldn't recognize me if I saw her in the street. There's nothing...
So do you exempt her from your earlier comment talking about the chancellors at the extension of these people who came from the outside 3 to 5 years to build a career and move on?
Yeah, I do. I do, because she came here and stayed long enough. I think it was 5+ years, maybe 6. And she really did some things. There are guys hidden in central administration today, I don't know a lot about what they do, which is part, I don't think anybody knows a lot about what they do, and I think you'd be hard-pressed. There were some people that came and stayed here 2 or 3 years and championed their next round of accomplishments and moved on to the next, whatever the next vice position up the ladder was for them. I don't think you could ever track what the hell they did here.
Uh-huh.
Maybe their boss, the chancellor, could. But Shalala, I don't fault her for the short tenure here. She was here long enough, did a bunch of things that were demonstrably her things, maybe because I intimately knew some of her staff people, and I had a little better sense of what was going on. I just felt when she represented the university, even if the first person singular was used a little too often, she represented it formidably and well. And you didn't tamper or trivialize the university activities in her presence. She knew how to stick up for what this academy was about. While there would normally not be much chance for interaction with the system president, through hit or miss arrangements, I guess, I wound up having some interaction. Catherine came here.
Catherine Lyle.
Lyle, as president of the system 15 years ago. And she had a public policy background and some planning background. Mm-hmm. I met her early on when she came in a briefing session that was set up by a friend to talk a little bit about state government and the university relationships and who were key players. Many years later, I had and still have a Native American PhD student who is not going to get done, I'm sure, but a Native American woman who was a friend of Catherine's. And Catherine and I was chair of the committee, but Catherine was on our PhD committee, so we had occasion to work together. And she would send me, as I got various nice news clips here and there, little handwritten notes about, I'd like to hire your PR officer and stuff like that. And I always liked her. I thought she did a very admirable job as system president, a very tough situation. And she was also the person, I had no hesitation when the extension dean was maligning my role and things, to directly communicate with Catherine and talk about what an inept and misinformed and mistaken guy this was on the facts. And I would have been happy to have had any factual investigation. They'd have had to fire him almost immediately for his incompetence, mm-hmm, if they ever looked into it. So having this relationship with a system president who I had a very positive regard for, and she knew that I was competent and honest, probably didn't hurt me over the long run. And when we got into the Waters of Wisconsin effort, in which the university had helped place their imprimatur on that effort as well, I think Catherine Lyle's office was very supportive of it, and the fact that I was one of the people involved probably furthered that effort.
There's no question. She told me so, because I went over to talk to Catherine as the past president of the Wisconsin Academy. And at that time we had Kurt, you, and John Magnuson. And she said, well, those are good people.
Yep. So, but that she was very good. And our current, our current chancellor, this is being recorded at a time when there's a lot of angst and personnel issues. They're grabbing headlines and lots of political machinations going on. But I think John Wiley has been a very, very fine chancellor in difficult times. What you see is what you get. There's no games. He comes out of as a materials scientist and engineer. I remember when John took over the graduate school, I went up with a team from the Institute for Environmental Studies to explain what we were about and our graduate programs and our interdisciplinary research. And John said, well, you don't have to explain it to me. I was head of the Materials Science Center. That's interdisciplinary. And I was thinking to myself at that time, let's see, a materials scientist, engineer, and a chemist, and he thinks that's interdisciplinary work. I think he's got a ways to come before he sees the full breadth of what we're about. But John grew every day. He was direct. He was personable. I just think he's been a very good leader. Very difficult times for the university, and I don't know how he's going to fare in the result of the, as a result of the present political situation, but I think he's just been a blue chip guy. And for the most part, university administrators, Peter Spear seems to have been, my interactions with him were positive. We deal with these guys when we go through accreditation processes, generally supportive. The only thing that was never forthcoming was the kind of resources that exist in so many other campuses for planning programs. Mm. Maybe it's because we have the La Follette Institute here and they drained off some whatever little surplus resources there might have been, but they would contend that they've not been treated luxuriously at all as well. And maybe we just, maybe these days it takes a $25 million outside gift to get the kind of building that pulls together the pieces for the kind of future that I would like to see for IES, ERPL, landscape architecture, Center for Computer Graphics, Land Information Systems. There's a lot of complementary pieces that would have a synergy that would be just phenomenal if we can get them in one building, and yet that building isn't about to be forthcoming, even though there's been ongoing talks about green buildings and citing green buildings without an external gift, it looks like. I mean, it's just the way the game is played these days. In looking ahead, I'm quite worried, and we've moved from a respect for the university system in terms of the political apparatus of the state to always some tension, as there will be. Intellectual institutions are a force for change, and change produces enemies. Mm. But and the university has certainly, with active student bodies, whether it's civil rights, environment, unionization of the teaching assistants, whatever it is, these are issues that legislators, particularly outstate legislators, might not be very sympathetic to, and it looks like disorder, and they expect a lot more hierarchical control of the system here. But the erosion of support, the lack of understanding for what a complex research institution like this does, the ever-declining state component of support for the university, and really the denigration of some of the activities of the university. They can recognize business school activities, stem cell research, new engineering and fusion research, mm-hmm. Something like that. But oftentimes not much respect for the entire intellectual enterprise and the role that the university plays in creating an informed citizenry and stimulating excitement and creativity in people with the potentials unknown, but with the potential to be realized. Some of that just gets lost, and it's become a lot more problematic if you take a look, as you said, that we're a mid-sized state, we're right in the middle of the pack, and we're watching our support for education shrink in the direction of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So that is going to begin shaping the future of the university. The university doesn't see itself as a state agency, as there's less and less funding available from the state. We're a $600 million a year research enterprise, all kinds of external fee-related kinds of funding. We've got a big endowment program here. There's less and less obligation to be tied to the state in the classic tradition of a land-grant university with its roots embedded throughout the landscape of the state. All of that is happening against a set of national trends where I think the land-grant universities are struggling. The extension service, as I indicated earlier, is an idea whose time may have come and may not be able to adapt to the future. And the land-grant model, which is one of the most powerful ideas that the United States has produced, in terms of the use of universities in development activities. And we've adjusted it in Wisconsin to deal with small business and all kinds of other very innovative things. I think it's very much threatened at the national level because there's a perception that they've sort of done their thing. And I think there will be erosion of support for the land-grant research mission. Part of it's of their own making. Part of it is they've been bedfellows. The land-grant colleges of agriculture in particular have been bedfellows of the traditional production agricultural industries. They've had blinders on in terms of the wider set of impacts and concerns, such as early on trivialization of sustainable agriculture, the organic food movement, No issues about how they connect to urban constituencies and people of color. It's as if the whole thing was a technical exercise in building chicken condominiums or messing around with the genetics of cows or finding a way enzymatically to extend the shelf life of a vegetable. Mm-hmm. And I say this in a university where we've had a strong land tenure social science component, but even here, the lack of support for a venerated institution like the Land Tenure Center, which around the world, highly recognized, struggling here, instead of trying to really commit resources to dealing with land tenure questions, they were ready to throw it out until it was rescued by voluntary faculty efforts in a kind of an outcry. Yeah, you can travel all over the world and there's support for that. Well, I sit there and wonder how we're willing to allow that great tradition with its implications internationally to go by the board, something like the Land Tenure Center. Small nickel and dime operation, but very, very important symbolically and intellectually in the life of people all over the planet and in the underdeveloped world. That's worrisome. And I'm roaming here, Bob, and talking about, because I don't have a convergent, focused view of what the University of Wisconsin-Madison looks like in 25 or 50 years. I've got friends who are in the long-distance education business. They own things like e-college, who think that these traditional models of education are going to be anachronized soon. And yet I can't help but see the interpersonal role. I've built a career on that, and of course I have some vesting then. But the interpersonal kinds of training, the role modeling, the kind of thing that happens tête-à-tête,
yes.
And in the most human of ways, somehow I see that particularly in at some of the elite levels of graduate training is not going away, that sort of thing is just very, very important. But I think that fiscal stressors are going to force efficiencies on the system of long-distance learning and other kinds of learning approaches that will make the University of 2050 a lot different than the one of 2005. And so much of it depends upon public support for universities. Mm. And there's this increasing separation, both in financial wherewithal and in perceptions of the universities, fed by various politicians, particularly the right-wing theocracy, which I think is the greatest threat to civil liberties and intellectual pursuits in the United States. It is a huge threat. I mean, we've been painted with a left-wing kind of thing, liberal bastions, bad values in terms of family, anti-religious, and on and on. You can't keep chipping away at universities like that in a broad stripe without starting to impair the perception of universities and the support for universities. Universities are clumsy, not very efficient kinds of places. They don't have hierarchical order to them. It's in fact the disorganization that allows ideas to flourish and innovation to come about. And it could be very, very stifling, particularly in a climate where people take pride in saying that they're not reality-based, that empirical things are not, they're intuitive or faith-based or whatever. Well, universities can't operate as faith-based universities, not as major centers of inquiry and thought. Maybe you can if you're some little southern religious university, I won't name any, but a great university that has to be able to challenge across every doorway of knowledge cannot do that. And yet, all of our activities in the university and learning enterprise happen at a time when people are bastardizing the use of science and dealing with climate change or hiding numbers in terms of the condition of the disadvantaged populations of the world, mm-hmm. Don't want to learn from any prior experiences, are working with worldviews and philosophies that are just intuitive or ideological or faith-based, and don't bring me any information to the contrary. Well, how can that work in favor of universities? And still, I'm no student of this. I've just labored in the temple here for a while, and I'm a critic of the university in a fair number of ways. But they're a unique institution on the American landscape. They provide avenues for human development that we simply don't offer in other kinds of ways. And this university is a particularly spectacular place. I don't want to sound like I'm bleeding badger red and singing varsity. But the university has been very adaptive at trying to deal with its large size and finding niches and smaller communities and intellectual enterprises for students. And unfortunately, when the larger fiscal and political diatribes play out, these experiments get lost in the mix. We get lost on all the wrong things in terms of public focus, and our support gets underpinned or undermined. And so I'm quite worried about the kind of march to mediocrity that could very easily happen, and it wouldn't take very long for the great University of Wisconsin-Madison.
This concludes the interview scheduled for today, July 6, 2005.